Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello and welcome to the Sandeep Roy Show on Express Audio.
The Sandeep Roy Show.
Mahatma Gandhi's birthday has now settled into well-rehearsed rituals. Garlands at Rajghat, tweets and platitudes, and debates about his relevance. As the generation that knew him recedes, he becomes even more of a two-dimensional figure whose name adorns a street in pretty much every Indian city and whose face is on India's currency notes. But when we read his letters to friends, family, and opponents, or their accounts of their encounters with the Mahatma, we get a more three-dimensional picture of Gandhi, even flashes of his sense of humor. His grandson, Gopal Krishna Gandhi, the former governor of West Bengal, has compiled and edited A Frank Friendship about Gandhi's long history with Bengal, a state that brought him great joy and also tested his life's philosophy most deeply. As he himself said, "I am not able to leave Bengal, and Bengal will not let me go." Gopal Krishna Gandhi joins us on the show from Chennai. Gopal Krishna Gandhi, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Do you have an October 2nd ritual for yourself?
I would say yes. There are many things about October 2nd which make me proud, but there are many more things about October 2nd which make me concerned, which make me reflect with a mix of anxiety and hope.
Like what?
The future of our country as part of an imperiled planet in which nearly 12,000 nuclear warheads, which can be deployed at any moment, can turn our planet into a vapor of smoke by terror or error or swagger. And the prospect of global warming sending oceanic waves into all our coasts. And third and most important, the prospect of the pandemic mutating into variants that we have not anticipated through animal to human travel. And beyond this, at the level of human relations, the deepening suspicion and lack of cohesion between communities across the world, including India. So that is what makes me more anxious than proud or optimistic.
That is a very interesting point which comes up in this book often, where you're struck by the fact that how many people Mahatma Gandhi had relations with whom he differed politically, sometimes very severely, but that didn't seem to get in the way of building a certain relationship of trust and respect between each other.
His first approach to anyone in life, not just in politics or in public life, but in life, was to trust implicitly and put all arising thoughts of doubt to a side. And until completely disappointed and shocked by behavior, to continue that trust. And even when shocked and disappointed, to try to resume an equation on the basis of trust. And wherever a compromise was possible that did not dilute his fundamental ethical principles, to go for that compromise. And in the matter of India's political freedom and India's social emancipation, he met adversary opinions and contrary opinions with a very clear and limpid faith in the other person's goodness, in the other person's good intentions, and therefore building bridges. So he was essentially a builder of bridges.
There's a quote, I think it's C.R. Das's quote, that he himself uses, which is, life is larger than politics, right? He seemed to very much believe in that.
And since you have by chance led me into that analogy of bridges, I just want to say that in respect of Bengal, the most abiding image is of him walking barefoot on extremely fragile bridges in Noakhali and over streams and eddies and clefts, unaided, and of course, aided by the song Atta Chamari, Walk Alone.
We're going to come to Noakhali, of course, because that's such a pivotal part of this book. But this book, Frank Friendship, which is about Gandhi and Bengal, and before he becomes the Gandhi, we know the thing that really shocks him about Bengal and Kolkata and comes up again and again are goats and Kalighat, where goats are sacrificed. And there's a point where he says, I asked Harilal, his son, not to settle in Calcutta on that account.
Yes, his response to what happens in Kalighat by way of the sacrifice of goats was very much like Rabindranath Tagore's description of it in his extraordinary work, Visarjan, in which Tagore talks of animal sacrifice with something like disbelief. And Gandhi was just expressing his own views very emphatically and clearly in this, as a person who could not connect the sacrificing of animals with the devotion to the Creator.
What did you find out about what Bengalis, who are known to, you know, love their food and sometimes are accused of being a little lazy, what did they make of his Puritan and very austere lifestyle?
There is something in the Bengali mind which is extremely happy to engage with differences. The Bengali mind, I don't think, wants to see a mirror of itself or a monochromatic replication of its own styles. It revels in change, which is why Bengalis make such excellent travelers. Gujaratis and Bengalis have this in common. They love travel and they do so with style, engaging with new cultures, with new terrains, new cuisines, new music, but keeping their own identity. And so I don't think they were ever uncomfortable with Gandhi or Gandhi with them because of this trait of almost finding some pleasure in wonderment, the joys of surprise outdoing the comforts of repetition.
And he keeps scolding them in many meetings for not knowing and not wanting to know Hindustani. And he says, a time will come when we shall all feel ashamed to use English.
He, I think, had discussions with almost every province in India on the subject of Hindustani, provinces which did not speak Hindustani, advocating Hindustani as a link language. And of course, he did the same in Bengal. But the point to remember and the point to celebrate, I think, and also the point to admire in his approach was that his advocacy of a link language and that link language being the language of the large number of Indians, Hindustani, was accompanied by a simultaneous fascination with Bengali. So that he learned Bangla, tried to learn Bangla from the very first time that he heard that language spoken, right up to the very last day of his life when he was practicing the script.
And that was partly because he also wanted to read Rabindranath Tagore in the original.
Yes, I don't think he got very far in that, though he knew several of his songs in Bangla in the original, speaking them, talking about them, humming them, and even singing them.
This book is so impressive. I mean, it's 600 plus pages. So there's obviously a lot in connection with Gandhiji and Bengal. What do you think was the role Bengal played in the man Gandhi became?
Well, he looked upon Bengal as the rest of the country looked upon Bengal, as a leader of opinion, harbinger of new ideas, new vigor, and also as a collectivity of people that have become indispensable to the British Empire for their sheer intellectual caliber. This was not a comparative attraction. He was not setting off Bengal against other states or parts of India, but he was just drawn to Bengal for the eminence which geography, history, and politics had invested it with. And it just so happened that when he was in South Africa, very young, still not so well known outside the Indian community of South Africa, and he was visiting India from South Africa as an Indian South African, his boat brought him and deposited him in Calcutta. And so after Ahmedabad and Bombay on the western seaboard, it was Calcutta on the eastern seaboard that he experienced, both by the way in which he was welcomed by Calcutta's personality and rebuffed by Lord Curzon sitting in the Governor General's residence in Alipur.
So he didn't have the same thing with problems in other Indians often have with Bengalis. Oof, they're too full of themselves, just obsessed with themselves and their Bengaliness. This did not exasperate somebody trying to build a national movement.
His wanting to trust others included his dramatic inclination to admire others, to see the good qualities, as one may call them, or the interesting features, as one may call them, of the other person. And I think when he came to Bengal and to Bengalis, he saw that awareness of their own merit had a charm to it. And that is why he said something like, these are not his exact words, but almost near what he said, that Bengal is convinced that India is part of Bengal. And I think that is just wonderful, because Bengal's great pride in itself embraced its pride in India and made India part of Bengal's own persona.
And what did he make of Bengal's propensity for violence as well? The fact that so many of the revolutionaries who favored violent means were from Bengal. Did he have thoughts on that?
His awareness of the school of violent action in Bengal paralleled his awareness of the school of violent action, for instance, in Punjab and in the Bombay Presidency, the Maharashtra part of the Bombay Presidency, and also in the Deep South. And he saw in this an expression of sheer patriotism. It was the methodology that he could not accept and saw as sheer folly, because any violence against the Raj was bound to generate counter-violence of extremely stronger dimensions.
Talking about some of the major personalities that come up in the book, one of the foremost is obviously Rabindranath Tagore. What do we know about what their first encounters were like, the impressions they had of each other? Because we do know that they did not necessarily see eye to eye, even though Gandhi calls him the poet and Tagore calls him Mahatma.
They did not see eye to eye, and I don't think they tried to find common ground on all matters. But they were aware of the magnetism of each other, the voltage of each other's personality. But I think the point of congruity, the point of concordance between the two, was their recognition in each other of India's superiority over colonial intentions. That India was too big not just in terms of size of people and country and land, but in terms of its heritage, to be under the heel of a handful of imperialists and colonialists who had scant knowledge, let alone regard of India. To look for differences between Gandhi and Tagore is to little recognize the essentiality of their mutuality. To look for differences in Gandhi and Tagore is to try to pick the unexpected and unwanted gravel in the bowl of rice.
I read something in the book which I didn't know about, which really moved me. When Tagore is very elderly and struggling to find money for Shantiniketan, he basically embarks on a tour with a troupe performing the dance drama Chandalika, I think, or Chitrangada, I forgot, Chandalika, to raise money in 1936. And it is Gandhi who comes and says, you shouldn't be doing this. You go back home. I will get this money for you.
Ironically speaking, there was a poetic truth to what Gandhi was saying. He was recognizing the inability of a purely aesthetic sensibility to engage in a purely material objective, which is raising money. And Not that Gandhi did not have an aesthetic side to him. He did indeed. His writing in Gujarati was of a very high order. And I think if he had not become what he was, he would have been a Gujarati Tagore. But here he said to poetic effulgence, which is what Tagore was, you are, Gurudev, not meant to waste your energy on this mundane, quotidian task. I am doing it all the time for my public causes. I am a prince of paupers, a king of beggars. I know how to beg for money from people who can afford it for our public causes. I will do it for you.
And he raised, I think, 60,000 rupees in 1936. That's an enormous amount. Do we still not know where it came from?
So there is no secrecy or mystery about it. He asked Ghanshyam Das Birla to contribute, and there must have been others. But I do know that he asked Ghanshyam Das Birla to make one of the initial contributions, which came without any persuasion, for Tagore was what he was, and Shantiniketan was known to be what it was. Gandhi was not doing something which was in itself difficult. It is just that he turned the key, which was already in his hand. So there was a beautiful poetic concordance in this genius at raising public contributions, working with the prince of poets.
Tagore, of course, is a huge figure, you know, or Subhash Bose. These are major figures. But there's so much letter and correspondence with minor people in this book. Sometimes it's a letter he's writing to somebody's widow or somebody whose brother has died and all of that. I read somewhere that he used to write 80 to 90 letters a day. Like, given the kind of busy life he led, why he was so invested in that kind of intimate level of correspondence?
Letter writing was for him a very natural and organically received method of communication. He wrote letters for, I think, two, three reasons. One was that he received a large number of letters, and something in him, something of sheer, what can be called etiquette and courtesy, made him reply to all the letters that he received, or most of the letters that he received. So that was one. The other was he loved the process of writing a letter. His letters were generally brief, almost telegraphic, and packed with content. He did not try to make a single literary flourish in what he was writing. It was simple communication expressed through what may be called critical minimum of words, with the cleanest and the leanest, I'm sorry, I'm borrowing a phrase from Indigo aircraft. And this is a point of detail, which is something which Tagore would have appreciated. He loved the craft of transferring ideas into ink on paper, folding the paper, placing the letter into an envelope, which perhaps he himself has made, writing the address very clearly, legibly, and seeing to it that it caught the last clearance from the nearest letterbox. The whole thing was an organic exercise. And curiously, while he boycotted everything in the Raj, when he was in the boycott mode, law courts, universities, colleges, schools, he never boycotted the post office. He used those, like the railways, to great effect. His letters to people who were not iconic are as important as his letters to those who loomed large on the Indian horizon. And not just in terms of number of letters. They were not always 80 or 90. They were sometimes very much less than that. Sometimes they could be even more. And I don't think the average was as great as 80, 90, but it could reach that figure. Not just the number of letters, but another thing about his letters were very important. A letter that he writes to His Majesty the King, or to the Prime Minister of Great Britain, or to Gurudev, is as important as a letter he's writing to an unknown correspondent, or to the daughter or the son of a friend, or to somebody whom he has just met very casually, or somebody whom he doesn't know at all. He attached as much importance to a non-entity as he did to a great figure. And this just came to him instinctively.
You ever wonder how he would have been in an age of social media?
I have indeed. he would have bent the social media to his national purpose and not the other way around. He was so good at another rectangular box, which was the charkha. He knew how to spin, but he also knew how to open the box, clean it, repair it, put the spindle into it, put the bobbin into it, run it, oil it, get music out of it, and send a huge, powerful impulse out of it. He would have done the same with the rectangular box called the laptop.
However, he did once fall for what we would now call fake news when he got inadvertent thing that Subhash Bose had been killed, right? He issued a statement that
he was a victim of what can be called the manufacturing imagination of the media. But I think he would have returned it in kind by a barrage of truth and facts, for he was a master communicator. If he called Gurudev poet with a capital P, we can call Gandhi printer with a capital P, because he not only was an author, an editor, and a publisher, but a printer as well, for he knew the art and science of the printing machines, running Indian Opinion with his own hands, with his colleagues' help, of course, great colleagues, and founding the newspapers in South Africa in three languages, in India in English, Hindi, and Gujarati. And as the great activist P. Sainath has said, Gandhi's journals had a circulation which was incredibly thin. And Sainath raises his fingers and shows how thin those circulations were. But papers with that circulation of no importance had an impact that was of a magnitude that is unimaginable. Today we have media which has circulation which is of a huge magnitude, but of impact, one need not say more.
Well, since we brought up Subhash Bose, there is actually a lovely photograph in the book of Subhash Bose seeing Gandhiji off at Howrah Station in 1938. The basic narrative now in favor is that Gandhi favored Nehru over Bose, and in the end, Bose leaves Congress and all of that. Looking through all their correspondence back and forth, do you think that is the accurate picture, or are there nuances we are missing?
Gandhi recognized in Jawaharlal Nehru a future of great promise for young India. He just saw in Nehru the kind of energy, the kind of vision that young India moving into the dawn of freedom needed. But here were others whom he respected, admired, and loved, like Vallabhbhai Patel, Subhash Chandra Bose, and saw that their roles were cut out for them as well. But the helm has only place for one pair of feet. So it was not Nehru over others, but it was Nehru for the helm, because he thought that is what the ship needed. And the others would be playing their great roles. But he also knew always that there was nothing called indispensable in anybody. He, for instance, did not think himself to be indispensable at all. He was ready and prepared to disappear from the scene at any moment. And of course, whenever he undertook a fast, he was ready to exit from the world at the end of that fast, though he also wanted not to come back to life with his purposes achieved.
But is there any indication from the letters we have, say, from between them, that Subhash Bose ever felt that Gandhiji was treating him unfairly?
There is no doubt that both Subhash and Sardar Vallabhbhai, and at other occasions, other personalities like Rajagopalachari, may have wondered why certain opportunities were not given to them or did not come to them with Gandhi's blessings. Of course they would have. They're all human. And he wrote back explaining the position. And Nehru himself felt very isolated and sidelined when somebody else was at the helm. I mean, Congress presidentship. Again, it's not as if Gandhi was some kind of a crown maker or a king maker who said, this time you. No, it was not like that. But Gandhi was what he was. And even when he said, I'm not a member of the Congress Working Committee, don't ask me, how could he not be consulted? How could he not be asked? How could his views not be ascertained? So they were. And he indicated his mind. There was complete fairness, which is not to say that there was complete faultlessness. Gandhi was as fallible as anyone else. And in retrospect, one can say that in certain situations, in certain years, a particular occasion, he may have been better advised to do differently. Of course he could have. And he was, I think, all the greater for being all the more human, as capable as anybody else of judgment errors, terminology errors, and of course, action errors.
What would be an example that comes to your mind?
I think his stressing extreme, almost penance-like norms and tenets for best conduct was unfair to people around him. And when they didn't quite measure up to his expectations of them, they felt very small. I think...
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
The standards that he had adopted for himself were his decision and his choice. But to have asked others to exert the same moral pressure on themselves was not always fair. And his yardstick for public conduct, saying Congress minister should not accept a salary beyond this, should not draw travel allowance, should not live in government bungalows, was not either practical or necessary. But at the same time, he was also setting a gold standard. And in an era where we are surrounded by base metals and sheer lead, it is good to have a gold standard, which is what Gandhi was.
Do you think, can I say this because you are his grandson, do you think that gold standard was easier to have outside the home than in the home? Was it hard to be in Gandhi's family?
I can't speak for the family in Gandhi's time because I was only 2.5 when he was taken from us. But from what I've read and heard, the gold standard was very hard on the first son, on Harilal, who was himself made of his own kind of gold. And incidentally, Harilal's favorite cigarette was the gold flick. But Gandhi's gold was Gandhi's gold. And I think Harilal could not take this, especially in Calcutta, where Harilal had set up business, set up home. It was quite something for Harilal to be his father's well-known first son, expected to follow his father's well-known principles of conduct, personal, professional, business, very tough. And he paid a very tough price for it as well. But the other sons, I think, understood their father a bit better, not without difficulties also. But they all saw and felt the touch of that standard, touching and entering their own lives, and each his own way reflected the gleam, not the glitter of that gold. It was not made of material that shone, but a material that incandesced.
And in fact, some of those who opposed Gandhi in meetings and things would use the example of Harilal to show that if you're not able to reform your own son at home, how are you going to reform the hearts and minds of millions of people?
I think the unkind and the unfair said that, but most people did not. And if anybody had said that to Harilal, I think Harilal would have given it back to that person red hot. Gandhi would not have been allowed to be bad-mouthed by anyone in front of Harilal. But I should also say here that in the larger scheme, one does not know what the creator wants and expects from situations. There was a great role which Harilal was given by destiny, which was to offer to the world the image of a father who fails as a father, even as he triumphs as a leader, and whose failure as a father and admission of failure as a father becomes part of that triumph.
One of the great tests of his triumph and failure as a leader, of course, happens in Bengal when the massacres of Hindus happen in Noakhali, the killings in Calcutta, and then leading to his great fast in Calcutta during independence. If you could quickly bring us to speed on, you know, what happened at Noakhali, which really made him say, I don't want to die a failure, but maybe I am a failure. He seemed to be really at a loss at Noakhali in a way he had not been before.
Just want to say here that the Emperor Ashoka, one of his edicts says, I'm never satisfied with what I have done. And he's carving his failure in stone. There was something like that about Gandhi. He had said similar things all through. He never claimed to have achieved anything by himself. When he left South Africa in 1914, came to India via London. In London, his first public speech, he says, I have had the limelight. My wife, Kastura, and I have had the limelight. But it is the simple people who joined my struggle, hundreds of them, who are unknown. They are the heroes and heroines of the struggle. So in Noakhali, then his life's aim of bringing the people of the two great religions of India, Islam and Hinduism, together, was floundering. Despite all that he had been doing and saying, he chastised himself, not those whom he was working with and working amongst, but himself. He went to Noakhali where Hindus were being massacred by Muslims. And his point was that innocents are being massacred by the violent, the virulent, who need to atone. Same time in Bihar, Muslims were massacred by the Hindus. And the man is just torn, literally torn between these two places where identical butchery is happening. And he says to himself, I think I've been a failure. And Nirmal Bose, the great anthropologist who traveled with him, in his book, My Days with Gandhi, records that he once saw Gandhi in one of the huts in Noakhali talking to himself, a very unusual thing for Gandhi, talking to himself saying, what shall I do? What shall I do? And I'm so very sad that Nirmal Babu does not say what language Gandhi said this in. Whether he spoke in English, what shall I do? Is it possible that in Noakhali he was saying to himself in English, what shall I do? Or was he speaking in Gujarati? Or was he saying it in Hindi, Hindustani? Main kya karu? I wish he had, because that would have given him a real feel to this. But this was his state of mind. He was not only fallible, but aware of his human limitations.
And one of the things he does do, in fact, in the middle of Noakhali, he embarks on his famous, I don't know what you call it, he called it yajna or experiment, where he sleeps in the same bed with as his grandniece Manu, because he seems to really think that his sexuality has an impact on things far beyond him.
In South Africa, took to the Brahmacharya vow right after the great Zulu rebellion when he was out in the field, in the theater of violence. And it was during that agonizing experience of violence around him, of inhuman actions, that he felt in South Africa that there is a commonality between the purification of oneself and action in the public sphere to correct wrongs in the public sphere. That he has to be the purest instrument available for cleaning the vilest of human behavior. This is how his Brahmacharya started in South Africa. 42 years later, almost, a very similar thing happens in Noakhali. He feels that perhaps his failure is due to something wrong in his own ethical being. And he's putting himself to tests which are completely open under the sky. the tests of his moral fiber. One has to see Gandhi in the tradition of the great ascetics who put themselves through agonizing mortifications along a code of self-analysis and self-correction that is not part of the normal code of humans. And the self-purification that he sought through fasting in what he tried in Noakhali through his brahmacharya, self-testing, are the same.
But nobody around him really approved of it. His stenographer quits because he can't countenance it. Others, even though they may not doubt his motives, were not in favor of it. For you, looking back after this all these years, how do you reflect on the man you see there, you know, that he wouldn't budge an inch from what he was doing because he felt it was right, but it was making everybody around him so uncomfortable? And I don't think we do know even whether Manu Gandhi in later years reflected on that at all, did she?
Manu Gandhi may have reflected on it, but she was an extremely intelligent and sensitive soul herself. And I think she understood the yajna completely. But what is very important for us to know is that the colleagues who said to him, why are you doing this? Said, why are you doing this of all times now? So they were dismayed by the timing of this. When you're probably doing the most difficult thing of your life, why now? Why should you take the risk of controversializing what you're doing? So he saw, he said, I know what I'm doing. I am the instrument of what I'm doing. And I want that instrument to be perfectly pure as I'm doing it. But I take your point. I don't quarrel with your telling me that I should not do it, but leave me to do what I think I should be doing. But a point was reached in Noakhali when Amritlal Thakkar, later known as Thakkar Bapa, said to him, look, Bapu, I think you have tested yourself in this enough now. I don't think you need to prove this to yourself any further. You are as brahmachari as any brahmachari can be. So don't you think there is such a thing called the proper time to conclude a test? And Gandhi said, yes, I think you're right. I don't have to do this beyond what is strictly necessary. And he just let that test drop aside and continue what he was doing. So he was very realistic and practical also within his idealism.
This reminded me something I didn't know about, which I thought was fascinating, was there are these letters which he is writing to a niece of Tagore's, Sharula Devi Choudhurani, whom he refers to as his spiritual wife. Was that somebody he actually fell in love with?
He has answered this very effectively and repeatedly. And he says, yes, I was drawn to her. And then he says to discussants later that it was a moment of folly, that he would have fallen had it not been for those around him who told him that what he was doing was wrong, the struggle, but the perspective of his own personality. And he says, they pull me back from the precipice. So it is important for us to know that here was a man then very much younger than the Gandhi we speak of as the Mahatma, who had seen in this amazing poet herself and singer and musician, who had bridged Bengal with Punjab, marrying great Punjabi patriot Ram Bhajdat Chaudhary. He had been taken by her personality and wanted an exclusive equation with her, which he found later was foundationally wrong, because he was not in favor of exclusive equations with anyone, and he withdrew from it. And it has to be said to both his and Saradevi's credit that the larger issue of India's political struggle going ahead with all the struggling leaders and the struggling led giving their best did not have room for exclusive relationships.
But do people like Acharya Kripalani have a point when they say that, and this was, he was talking in terms of the Manu Gandhi episode, saying that while his motives might be pure, he's treating women as a means rather than as an ends in themselves.
There are certain exchanges in the world which have necessarily to do with another person. Certain equations which can never be the work of a single person.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And just as one cannot marry a theory, one cannot try Brahmacharya in the abstract, that Gandhi chose his methodologies after not just reflection, but consultation, especially with Kasturba, shows that Gandhi was observing a certain correctness and a certain rectitude. But Acharya Kriplani is absolutely right in telling his leader, and Acharya Kriplani, incidentally, is one follower who was a follower but never a disciple, as he himself said, and gave himself the latitude to be able to speak critically to Gandhi. Was absolutely right in conveying what he said to Gandhi in no uncertain terms. And thank God that we have these conversations, Gandhi with Nirmal Bose, Gandhi with Acharya Kriplani, Gandhi with Sardar Patel on this very subject. Just as we have conversations, Socrates with his surrounding followers, so ably reproduced by Plato in the Republic.
Speaking of conversations, I wanted you to read a little conversation which is between your two grandfathers, basically. And the setting here is Calcutta. Sri Rajagopalachari is then the governor, and Mahatma Gandhi has come here because of the killings that are happening around the time of independence. And he's taken up this house in Beleghata, which is in his very humble house. But the killings are still continuing, and Gandhi is debating whether he will go on fast or not. And this is the conversation he has with Sri Rajagopalachari, the first governor to visit Gandhi. Until then, Gandhi had been the one going to governor's house.
And I must say, in the context here, that you were talking of Manu. Manu, who kept a diary of all this and recorded these conversations along later on with Pyarelal. And but for Manu, the diarist, he would not have known some of these highly nuanced conversations. So Rajaji is first governor. He has been sworn in at 1 a.m. on the 15th of August. And Gandhi is in Beleghata at that time. And he calls on Gandhi, and as is always done, here is the governor. He must have come in a governor's car with some security, not as much as governors now have, but some security, certainly with an ADC. But instinctively takes off his slippers outside and walks through this long, dusty room to the corner where Gandhi is seated. And then he talks on his first visit. And later on, after Gandhi has decided to go in this fast to stem the riots, the following happens. And in the records, Manu and Pyarelal, I read now, when Rajaji came in at 10 p.m., Gandhiji showed him his draft. Glancing through it, Rajaji, with his usual affectionate banter, remarked, "You don't expect me to approve of your proposed step?" Proposed step was his fast. "You don't expect me to approve of your proposed step?" Together, they took stock of the situation and flashed threadbare the issues at stake. Rajaji, "Can one fast against the gundas?" Gandhiji, "I want to touch the hearts of those who are behind the gundas. The hearts of the gundas may or may not be touched. It will be enough for my purpose if they realize that society at large has no sympathy with their aims or methods, and that the peace-loving element is determined to assert itself or perish in the attempt." Rajaji, "Why not wait and watch a little?" Gandhiji, "The fast has to be now or never. It will be too late afterwards. The minority community cannot be left in a powerless condition. My fast has to be preventive if it has to be of any good. I know I shall be able to tackle the Punjab too if I can control Calcutta. But if I falter now, the conflagration may spread. And soon I can see clearly, two or three powers will be upon us, and thus will end our short-lived dream of independence. Rajaji, but supposing you die, the conflagration will be worse. Gandhiji, at least I won't be a living witness to it. I shall have done my duty. More is not given to a man to do. Rajaji capitulated.
Thank you. That is really moving. And this fast worked. I mean, when people started coming in and surrendering weapons, had that kind of thing actually happened before with his fast, where people actually surrendered guns?
Gandhi never claimed to be unprecedented. And I don't think historically it would be right to say that such a thing had never happened before, because fasting for moral persuasion, almost amounting to moral coercion, has been known in the Indian tradition. And so without claiming uniqueness for Gandhi, I think I should say that the impact of a fast by a political icon with a spiritual voltage worked unexpectedly because of the backing which Gandhi's fast got from the solidarity of the people of Bengal, the people of Calcutta. While Gandhi fasted, the people of Calcutta were behind him, stood with him in complete solidarity, in understanding, knowledgeable solidarity, not just sentimental solidarity. And it was therefore combination of one man's stature and the populace's extraordinary backing that made what Rajaji called the Gundas buckle.
You didn't get to know Gandhi as a grandfather, but you did get to know Rajaji a bit. What kind of stories would he share about Mahatma Gandhi? Actually, were you as a boy curious about that, or was Gandhi a history book figure for you?
I don't have memories of Gandhi myself, because I was 2.5. But I have been told by many people that when I used to be taken by my parents to Gandhiji's prayer meetings in Delhi, in his last few weeks in Delhi, I used to go and sit with him. And when he used to start the meeting by saying, "Shant ho jaiye," there was a lot of murmuring in the crowd, probably talking, "Shant ho jaiye, shant ho jaiye." I used to mimic him and say, "Shant ho jaiye, shant ho jaiye." And he loved that and laughed. And when he would start the prayer, he would look sideways, slowly open his eyes to see if I was also keeping my eyes closed. And he was, I think, generally not disappointed. And I'm told that on the day he was shot and I was taken by my parents to the house, and I saw him lying down and a lot of talk happening all around, I said, "Bapu so rahe, shant ho jaiye."
Gandhiji himself had a distaste for Gandhiism. He wanted it dead. He said, "I'm eager to see Gandhiism wiped out at an early date in the 1940s. Is he getting his wish now?
I think I've been asked sometimes, if I were to choose one quotation from Gandhi which was most important or telling, what would that be? And I've thought about it, and there are two of many. The one which is very important is his saying, "There is no such thing as Gandhism, and I do not want to leave a sect after me." That, I think, is very important. And Rajaji, whom you mentioned, was not a sectarian Gandhi. He was a wide awake Gandhian, which meant that he could engage with Gandhi, differ from him, follow him, embrace his ideas, contest them. Those who have made a cult of Gandhi and think they are a sect of Gandhi do not necessarily do either themselves or Gandhi any service. Certainly they do not help immediate purposes. What is important is for us to see where the man's example not just his words, is vitally important to this. And the other most memorable and I think the most important statement, sound or sentiment uttered by him is his final two words in his language of choice, He Ram, which invoked Rama, who was his most intimate and fervent idol, Purushottama Ram. He invoked him with the hope that the vast numbers of India's population who believe in Ram will see the futility of sectarian hatred.
And I know you yourself have just recently come back from the United States. You've been speaking about Gandhiji and your book, The Letters with Devdas Gandhi. And in the United States, people like Barack Obama have often mentioned Gandhi as an inspiring figure. And I wonder, given Gandhi's reputation and historical revisionism happening, could there be a time when Mahatma Gandhi would live on more outside India than at home?
He himself would not worry about where he lives or whether he lives at all. But I think Gandhi belongs to that league of thinkers and practitioners of the ethical way whom the world sees as world citizens. This is how Martin Luther King Jr. saw him, which is how the great civil rights leader and contemporary of Martin Luther King, whom we are fortunate enough to still have with us, James Lawson, thinks of him, and which is how Obama thought of him. And on the day after the assassination, the Chicago Tribune had a fantastic drawing. It can be called a cartoon, but it is one of the most moving things I've seen. It has Gandhi walking out of planet Earth, not just India, not focused on India, but planet Earth, walking out. He's just holding a piece of paper which says, Apostle of Peace. And the world is spewing fumes called hatred, intolerance, violence. Gandhi just stepping out of that into ether. And after Martin Luther King was assassinated, there was another extraordinary cartoon by the great Bill Mauldin in which Martin Luther King has just reached the heavenly levels that Gandhi already is. And Gandhi looks at Martin Luther King and says, the odd thing, Dr. King, the odd thing about assassins is that they think they have killed you. So Martin Luther King lives. Gandhi lives, though he cares not whether he lives at all.
Gopal Krishna Gandhi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for asking.
Gopal Krishna Gandhi has worked in numerous administrative and diplomatic positions. He was the 23rd governor of West Bengal and is the author of numerous books. He compiled and edited A Frank Friendship, Gandhi and Bengal, A Descriptive Chronology. Share your feedback on our show on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram at Express Podcasts. This show was produced by Shashank Bhargav and edited and mixed by Suresh Pawar. Thanks for listening. This is Sandeep Roy on Express Audio, and we wish you a happy festival season.